Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to another Uncovered podcast. I'm Jared Kimber. With me is Bayram Kazi. We're going to be talking about, well, so many things. A couple of genders of ashes. Tamer Mikbel's retirement, which was slightly longer than a constipated poo. Afghan versus Bangladesh. The World Cup qualifiers, plus, I suppose, the World Cup qualified. And Ambati Raidu, who also retired briefly, I suppose. In fact, maybe this is the retirement episode. I'm not sure. Bayram, let's start with the men's ashes. That was the big caboodle this week. That's obviously where I was as well. Three tests in, all of them have been close. I think person for person, you still say Australia looks like a better team. England aren't that much luck away from being 2-1 up themselves, although they've had all the best of the conditions probably so far. So, and you can't complain too much about luck when you pick someone who I don't think they had looked at wicketkeeping in quite some time after his broken leg and decided that he'd be fine in a test match, all these sorts of things. But the point is that this is a fantastically exciting, crazy, close Ashes so far. I think it's not 05 Ashes. The quality of the cricket isn't, as far as I can remember, Zach Crawley didn't play in the 05 Ashes. You know, the level of talent is slightly different. But it is an absolutely fantastic series from a three close tests over and over again after all the hype with big teams playing. So everyone's watching and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you could probably call it the best since the 05 Ashes. And yeah, I mean, England could very well have been 2-1 up at this stage, but good that they've won it headingly. It keeps the series alive. It keeps us spectators glued to our TV sets, which has been the case in this entire series or the three tests thus far. And I find it remarkable that after dropping 9,000 catches at headingly, I'd say, give or take, England have still managed to win. And instantly, that brings up, I guess, the burning question that do they persist with Johnny Bairstow as the glovesman? I mean, there's been so much talk around Ben Folkes being the best keeper in England. Stokes himself has called him the best keeper in the world. So you'd have to think that they must find a way to fit him in somewhere. But I just have a feeling or an inkling that England aren't going to do that. They're going to persist with Bairstow, aren't they?
Well, I mean, if they were going to do it, I suppose this was the test that they would have done it, right? They would have batted Moen Ali in a different position, and would have done that. But the truth is, and we talked about this before before the Ashes started, that if Ben Stokes can't bowl, which is pretty much where we look like we're at the moment, then the entire flexibility of that team disappears. And part of that flexibility, of course, is Ben Folkes coming in, right? If you have Moen Ali and Ben Stokes both bowling, you only need three specialists around them. It gives you huge flexibility. Best I could probably play in the team. And, you know, our Folkes bats at number seven, number eight, I suppose, if you wanted to, depending on the kind of teams you want to put together, and you'd be fine, right? That's not where we are. That's not how England are. On top of everything else, Ben Stokes' butt broke. Like, he also got hit in the balls at one stage. Like, everything's falling apart. He's back in the slips. We haven't seen him in the slips for a while since he broke his finger. But I think they just went, well, there's no point putting him anywhere else. He can't move, right? So, yeah, I think from that perspective, it was a very, very I think they were a little bit hamstrung. But your overall point makes sense, right? Like, if they had a wicketkeeper who had caught a normal amount of runs, I remember that Johnny Bairstow's made almost identical amount of runs to Alex Carey so far in the series. So if they had a wicketkeeper who caught the normal amount of takes, England would be probably 2-1 up at this stage, or at least maybe also, would have made the other test even closer. Could they have been any closer?
They could have been somewhat closer, I think. England should have won that first test. Okay, Edgbaston was England's game to lose. And you could say that at Lord's, they kind of made a fist out of it and they weren't ever supposed to get close in that game, right? So there's that bit of thing going on over there. But I personally feel that England are well balanced over here right now, given that Wokes and Wood have come into this team. I mean, Wokes was, you know, bringing in all of that experience. He had that composure at the end, took 6 wickets in the test match, scored some valuable runs. And Mark Wood was a revelation. I mean, he bowled with blistering pace. And that's just what the luxury that England were missing. To have an enforcer like that, you can run through the tail. And that's what Wood allowed them to do in the first innings. And he got a fifer. So Wood and Wokes, the two W's of England, who thought I'd ever say that before? But anyway, they combined to take 13 wickets and also 82 runs, if I'm not wrong. So that is a stellar contribution. And I think that inspired bit of selection, ultimately, you'd have to say, won England the test match. But do not forget, of course, Harry Brook. Of course, he was allowed to bat at his preferred position as Moeen decided to come bat at 3. So he got valuable runs in the second innings. We finally saw him, you know, live up to his billing, and he too was a hometown hero. You know, he's a Yorkshireman. And then Ben Stokes, on one good knee, scored that knock of 80, without which England were not even close to coming into this game or coming back into this game. So I think it's the combination of those 4 performances. But the question remains that does Ben Stokes then go on to risk the remainder of his cricketing career by playing at Old Trafford? Because clearly his knee is very, very faulty at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. The Harry Brook one's really interesting about the whole batting order thing, because he made runs down the order. And I'm not saying he made them because he went back down the order, but I thought that was probably his best innings in Test cricket, all things considered. You know, quality of the bowling, the pitch, and how everyone else was batting on that pitch and the way that he played. But he also didn't particularly look like he wanted to bat at number 3. And I don't know if I followed it enough to see if what the reason was it was a left-hand, right-hand thing, whether they sent Moeen Ali up just as a disruptor to put Australia off.
I think I read something in which Moeen had told Stokes that he's feeling it. You know, vibes. Of course, basketball runs on vibes.
So, oh, but that's okay.
He was
then
feeling it. He thought he could take them on at number 3. But that did allow to Harry Brook to bat lower. And I think that England will have to sort this out. Does Joe Root come and bat at number 3? Does Johnny Bairstow promote himself if there's another keeper to bat at 3? Or do they send in the Nighthawk? Because that's always an option.
Well, I think going forward, if Ben Stokes isn't the all-rounder anymore, surely he has to bat at 3, right? Surely that is the position that he has to go in.
Fair enough.
I think, you know, there's even been talk, of course, at times of him opening. I think George Dobell might have written a piece. If not, George Dobell was working on a piece at one stage about how Ben Stokes might open. So there's certainly something to be said for those sorts of things, of doing that. Because if he's not bowling, then you have to get the most out of him. But as you said, there's almost nothing left of Ben Stokes at this point. I think he was certainly played the last 2 tests here. But his knees aren't getting any better. He seems to pick up a new strain or a new pain every time he's out there. It's incredible to think of, like, by the end of it, it'll just be like all we'll see out on the field will be ginger hair, right? There'll be nobody left out there. Be like maybe it'll be like the head from Futurama, which I suppose is actually how Mike Brearley captained England, was a head from Futurama in many ways. So I mean, you talk about Wokes and Woods. I mean, if they thought, especially in Wokes' case, if they thought they were going to get that out of Wokes, they would have played it before, right? So I don't know if you could say it's brilliant selection. It was literally down to the fact that they couldn't pick Jimmy Anderson anymore. He clearly needed to rest and think about it. So there's a bit of dumb luck in that. Whereas Australia also had a huge amount of dumb luck. I mean, the reason that they almost won this test is essentially Mitchell Marsh, right? Who hasn't played any first-class cricket, wasn't supposed to play, comes from nowhere. And he's created that classic a situation where someone does really good as a fill-in and it actually like screws everything up. So what happens now? Do they drop Warner as an opener, right? Like, how do they fit all these players in? They're not going to drop Head, right? So Warner, you know, they're not going to drop Marnus. They're not going to drop Smith. Do they drop a bowler and do they play Green and Marsh as like the combined 4-5 bowlers? Probably not. Do they not play Murphy? And go without a spinner. Again, probably not. He wasn't really needed much in this test match. I thought he bowled fine in the first innings. Probably should have got Ben Stokes out a lot earlier than he did with the two drops back to back. But didn't bowl particularly well in the second inning. Part of that was I thought Pat Cummins actually forgot that he had to bowl him. And by the time he brought him on, it just wasn't, it wasn't a good time to bring him on. But
30
but
runs
think,
were required, right? When he brought him on. I thought that was a bit bizarre or something.
No, I think it was
right towards
that,
the end.
No, he brought him on the first time. I think he got the over before lunch. And then the second time he brought him on, Harry Brook was in. I think that's right. And Harry Brook was actually playing, played him really, really well all the way probably through this. I think he, I'm trying to think. No, Harry Brook didn't. I think Harry Brook's got a good record against Ospin. Maybe that was what I was confusing it with. But I just didn't think Cummins used him particularly well. Now, Old Trafford, the problem with that is that Old Trafford is a spinner's pitch. And so you are probably going to need a spinner to be able to bowl there. But it, it does show you that Mitchell Marsh has created very, very big problems. And the same with England, right? Wokes
you
was probably,
can probably
here for one test. And now Wokes is probably going to have to play. Robertson, Anderson, the Tongue. There's a lot of questions.
Lots of selection conundrums. I'll come to Australia first. I think the big one over here is David Warner. Does he play that test match or not? Because, you know, conventional wisdom suggests that Stuart Broad is going to get him out twice again. He would have had him 18 times had he not been dropped off his bowling, I think, at Lord's, was it? But I think Warner will find it very, very tough to retain his spot. Now, the question is, what do you do with the second opening slot? Do you bring in one of Marcus Harris or Matt Renshaw? I mean, you could do that, sure. But I feel like there's a lack of experience over there that might, you know, make the Aussies question that decision. You could also promote Travis Head as opener because he does it in ODI cricket. But then again, Head has been so successful in the lower middle order. I mean, he got runs again. He smashed that 77 when Australia needed it most. Had Australia won this game, it would have been that Travis knock ultimately. And Mitchell Marsh comes out of nowhere, slams 100. Like you said, no first-class experience. Pulling everything left, right and centre. Some booming drives in there. He has England to thank, of course, as well. Because Root dropped him early on when he was like on 9 or 13 or something like that. And then Cam Green is the best bouncer in this Australian team, you'd have to say. So, would you not play him? I think it might be a decent shout to maybe open with someone else and have both Marsh and Green. But I don't see that happening. And
but
Scotty Boland.
If you open with someone else, okay, right? Who do you open the batting with, firstly? You can't
maybe
just
Marnus.
Throw that out there. Hey?
Maybe Marnus.
Okay, so
Marnus
hasn't made any
informed.
Runs. Marnus hasn't made any runs, and you're now moving him to a position he doesn't bat in. Do you know what I mean? It's the same with England. There is no answers. That ultimately, we're at that point where I think Australia is the better team. I think England has a very good theory and you know, and also is playing decent enough cricket, not that far off the level that Australia has played. So you're at that theory now where the best 11 is no longer the best 11, right?
It's about
matchups. It's about, you know, what you can do for Old Trafford. It might be a situation where I don't think Australia would. There's no way. I haven't sent a message to anyone in the Australian camp, although I might send one later. But there's no way coming into this series, they thought, and what if at one stage we have Cameron Green as our fourth bowler and Mitchell Marsh as our fifth bowler, right? They would never, ever have even considered that as an option coming in. And right at the moment, even if they don't do it, there's no doubt there's someone at that meeting going, but, right? And the same with Warner. Warner hasn't had an unsuccessful Ashes, right? He hasn't been brilliant, but I mean, he's been, I'm going to try and bring this up as we talk, but my guess is that he's been more or less on a sort of similar level to Zach Crawley in that he's been, he maybe hasn't had the, you know, the attacking side that Crawley's had. But from a impact point of view, he's mostly been around to get rid of the new ball. As you said before, we know that he's going to be, what do you call it? We know that at any stage, Broads is probably going to get him. But he made 66 the previous test match, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not
played
like
well versus India as well in that first innings. Got 40 odd, I remember.
Yeah, I actually thought. So let's just have a look. I just want to find his record. Now I can't find it. So Warner has 141 runs. So he doesn't have a lot of runs, but he has quite a few starts, right?
Yeah.
He's got an average of 23. So Crawley's got an average of 32.
Good on you, Zach Crawley.
Yeah. Well done to him for having a slightly. And Crawley has 150 and Warner has 150. So there's a bit of a difference there, but there's not a massive amount of difference. Warner's down with Carey and Bairstow. And Labuschagne is probably the players who have struggled the most. But the point is that Warner has more often than not been handy at the top so far. If you take him away, you're taking a huge chance, and everyone has to move as well. Because if they move Warner, Manus has to move, but Steve Smith also has to move, right? And it's a bit what you were talking about before. If Brook goes back to his normal position, then Root has to move, right? Then someone still has to bat at number four, and maybe it's Brook. And then at that point, he's saying, is there that much difference between batting at three and four? I would say there's about 50 balls difference, although in this series, probably about 40 balls difference. Do you know what I mean? There's just absolutely no, this is so messy. And this is why test series over five matches are so incredible, because at a certain point, you end up with like this mishmash of these situations that don't happen. They now know exactly. The Warner Broad thing is so fascinating because Australia can go, Warner hasn't had as horrible a series as maybe the overall figures have shown, in that he's been able to nullify the new ball a few times and get Australia off to some starts. If nothing great, obviously, and he hasn't gone on to have a big impact. And also, they will say at the exact same time, but if Broad doesn't get him in his first spell, he's going to get him in his second spell. And that's going to be around the 20 to 25 over mark, which means that chances are, at best, Warner's going to get to 50 if he's scoring at a decent clip, right?
Also, you lose a fantastic slip fielder if you get rid of Warner. So he does add more value to the team. And Australia, look, they've got some stuff going right for them as well. You've got Mitchell Starc and Pat Cummins. They both got fifers at Headingley. They've looked very, very impressive. I think this is the best we've seen of Starc in Test cricket in a while. And that's really good. He's been swinging the ball. He's been, you know, has that rapid pace as well, still clocking around 90 miles per hour. But then Scotty Boland failed to take a wicket this Test match. So that's where, you know, the way Australia have been this pragmatic bunch, all Ashes, I wouldn't be very surprised if they go with both Marsh and Green. But then there are some questions to be answered over here. And I'd just like to see if they are reactive, or do they just stick to the same 11 and be like, okay, we've got a good bunch.
But this is why this is also fascinating, because everything you just said was right. Boland we probably won't see Boland or maybe Ollie Robinson again in this Ashes, right?
Yeah. I mean, I hope we don't see Ollie Robinson in the Ashes again, because I think Josh Tung didn't do much wrong to be removed from that team. And this is Old Trafford. This is Jimmy Anderson's home ground. If you're going to try him once more, this is where you try him. And I think it makes perfect sense for England to drop Robinson now. He can go on and write his columns for Wisden, and someone else can have a ball.
That's fine. Let's get back to Boland. So you say drop Boland, right? And I don't think we'll see Boland again in the Ashes. But in your system, what you just said, Hazelwood can't come back in the team.
Yeah.
And the thing about Hazelwood is, I don't think he's been bowling particularly well in this series. But he's got eight wickets at 32. And you're basically making a big call there that he doesn't play. You're also, from a physical standpoint, putting a lot of pressure on Cameron Green, who's already had a hamstring injury. And then also Mitchell Marsh, right? Mm-hmm. Who is also someone who breaks down quite a bit when he has to bowl. So the perfect situation here just does not exist, right? And that's why it's all so fascinating. And that's kind of what I'm saying. The further the sort of the five tests unleash or unravel, it's like, oh my God, you have to think about micro matchups. You have to think about how you fit people in. If Australia had won this test match, then they could have easily said to Cameron Green, we know you fit for the next test match, right? Just take a spell. We just want to see Mitch Marsh one more time, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think England bowled very well to Mitch Marsh, right? And I think if they bowl better to Mitch Marsh, I don't know if he will score again. And if that's the case, Australia will have a bit more understanding of Mitch Marsh, right? They can't do that now, right?
Well, the law
now
of averages
now they have to make a decision to win the next test, right?
The law of averages suggests that Mitch Marsh won't do well at Old Trafford, but then you just can't say that, right? Because he just scored a fantastic ton. And I don't think anyone has pulled the ball better, right? We saw some cracking pull shots from him. And even those
drives... He also got Crawley out twice.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure if you started playing professional cricket as a leggy, you'd probably get Crawley out twice at some point as well. But one thing I'd like to point out over here, actually, it's two things. One, that I think the Headingley surface was as good as it gets. This is one I want to see more of in this Ashes, because it gives England a better shot at winning. Those flat tracks did not give England a good shot at winning. And one thing that I was impressed from England's perspective, is that in the first innings, there was a period of play where they were just scoring at 3 runs per over. Now, that's not baseball. That means that they have actually adapted their style of play and are looking to be a bit more intelligent with respect to their approach. And I think that is a very, very key takeaway, but that not a lot of people are talking about.
No, I think you're right. I talked to Andrew Sampson and I was saying, I felt like the run rates were down in this test. And he said, overall, they're not down. He said, what's been happening is that teams have been ramping up and ramping down, which is kind of how you're supposed to play test cricket. That's not to say that the baseball element doesn't work, because when England needed the baseball element, that still was something, you know. So Zach Crawley getting off to a quick start every time, and Duckett as well, does actually...
Mark Wood.
Yeah, well, but the two openers puts the shooter off, right? Because they realize that they can't make too many errors early on. And that's a tricky situation to be in, right? If you're not 100% sure where you're going to be putting the ball, that is a very, very tricky situation from that point of view. So there are still parts of that system that worked very well. And of course, then Ben Stokes at the end. The Mark Wood innings is fascinating, because I actually think Mark Wood can bat. Mm-hmm. And he's clearly made a decision that he doesn't care if he can bat. He's just going to bat this way. But in this particular game, there was no better way to go. And in fact, when Pat Cummins batted in the third innings, I was next to Sam Allard from TalkSport. And Sam Allard's a massive KKR fan. And I just turned to him and I said, do you know what they need, Australia? They need KKR's Pat Cummins, right? They need the guy who just takes it on, because it was a good fast pitch. Right, the ball would have come onto the bat perfectly. Pat Cummins likes that, the pace coming in, not the first couple of balls, as I think Mark Wood approved in the first innings.
But he didn't even get the bat near the ball versus Mark Wood, right?
But we've seen him flat bat, you know, 92, 93 mile an hour balls before. He's a brilliant striker of the ball from that point of view, and it was really interesting that it sort of shows you why you do need a multitude of. And this comes back to that five test thing we were talking about before and how it unravels.
Yeah.
Because that was a perfect situation where all Australia really needed was maybe Pat Cummins would have got 20 runs off 50 balls by just squidging it around. But Pat Cummins could have hit 40 runs off 15 balls and completely upset England's plan for a couple of minutes. Or he could have, you know, gone on for a little bit, because they then would have had to bring Moen Ali on, which would have upset what they were trying. All these different things that you can do. That is why that sort of Nighthawk, or I don't know what would Mark Wood be, the imaginary horse of death of Mark Wood, right? That's why those sorts of things work. I've said a lot that, you know, Shardul is not an all-rounder, but Shardul's ability to be a chaos batter, right, is very, very valuable in a slightly different way. And I was commentating with Jeremy Coney, and, you know, we were spending a lot of time together in the share house, and we were walking into the ground. We were talking about Richard Hadley's batting, and, you know, we were sort of saying, you know, he's not, you know, he was probably not quite an all-rounder on the level that Kapil Dev and the other guys were. But we're talking about how his batting would transform in modern cricket. And obviously in T20 cricket, he was a brilliant hitter of the ball, so it would have gone very well. But we were even talking in test cricket. He probably would have been unleashed in test cricket to say, okay, well, you're going to bat at number eight. You might average 20, but we're hoping you average 20 with a strike rate of 120 and you scare the hell out of people. And occasionally you're going to bat at number three, and occasionally get about at number five. And, you know, you're going to, what would the paddle hawk, what would a steamboat paddle? I don't know. I don't know what Richard Hadley's nickname would have been as that kind of player. But all those players.
Oh, I got one for Mark Wood. He could be the woodpecker.
Oh, God, that's better than mine. I do like the imaginary horse of death, and I don't really know what it means as a phrase, but the woodpecker also. This is something, I was going to put this on Twitter and on Threads and anywhere else. Oh. At Mastodon, if I could remember what my login was. But have you ever thought about what your name would be if you were a computer character? Yeah, so let's say you're a professional cricketer and you make it to the top level of cricket, and then you... And then there's a cricket game version of you where they can't use your real name, right?
Have you
thought about what your name would be? Because I was in the shower earlier and I thought I would be Gerard Timber.
Ah, right? I like that.
Which I thought worked a lot. Anyway, if you have any, feel free to put them in the comments and we'll put
Beza.
Them in.
I'd go with Beza Kaz.
Beza Kaz. So what?
Yeah. So I'd be playing for Australia in this game, because it's a game.
Also, that's a lot of Zeds in your Beza Kaz. Of course, the most famous one of all time was
Shahid Akhti for Shoaib Akhtar in Cricket 07? That's one.
Yeah, but no, there's some players who have names which actually almost look like they're fake names of players. you know, Brendan McMullum, is that what it is?
That's a real cricketer. That guy plays for Scotland.
Mean. No, that's what I mean. There are cricketers with names that actually, there's, God, I've forgotten. Is it Brian Vittori that played for Zimbabwe? Yes. But Vittori was spelled V-I-T-T. Anyway. But yeah, if you have your own fake name, feel free to put them in. And if not, we'll I'll put some tweets out later and we'll see what sort of mad ones people can come up with themselves. From a neutral's perspective, it's just a fun Ashes, right? Like it's
it's lovely. Just,
you know, I was on the BBC before day four, and they were like, "Oh, you know, tell us the truth. You know, you want Australia to win." I said, "Look, I cover a lot of cricket, and if Australia win, I think it will be one of the closest 4-3-0 in three tests that we've ever had, right? And that doesn't mean that Australia is not better than England, and I still expect Australia to probably win this series. I haven't really changed from my 3-1 prediction, so I'm, you know, I'm more or less there. I just need a draw somehow, what I would say is that from the worst thing about this Ashes would have been if Australia had, you know, got those last couple of wickets. If, you know, every time Chris Wokes spooned the ball up in the air, it actually went to a fielder, and the muck would catch carried down to Scott Boland, and Alex Carey didn't make a mess of it, and all these sorts of things. So I did wonder. So I did basically say, like, from a cricket perspective, this is a big moment in an exciting series. You kind of want it to go as far as possible. So the fact that England have won this is quite important for I was going to say for the narrative, but I don't really mean the narrative. I really mean for the hype and for the interests and for, you know, cricket in the UK and also cricket in Australia.
And also cricket elsewhere. I'm sitting here in Pakistan and everyone is absolutely hooked to the Ashes because, like you said, the scoreline may read 2-1 and Australia's up, but England could very well have been up in the series. And all of those test matches have been so closely fought that it really is compelling test cricket. You're watching every single day with a lot of interest and you don't want the series to die out just yet. So all of my family, and I'm in like this big family reunion sort of thing, everyone was stoked that England won just because everyone is enjoying these Ashes so much and they don't want it to die out so early. So in that regard, I think this is a great advert for Ashes cricket. And I mean, I know this is thrown on or thrown out a lot that, test cricket is being saved or whatever. Test cricket is fine as is. This is proof of that, that I don't think the game is under threat when we're going to get these sort of matches.
Mm. I'll tell you something else. So IG said that he's happy for me because he saw I'd been invited to those shows. So I've been invited for those shows for years. So I think he's talking about when I was on Talk TV. So in 2009 Ashes, I did BBC and CNN. The difference now is that, and you know, all the way through, and most cricket journalists kind of knock them back because it's annoying to go and do those shows. So, for instance, I did BBC 5 Live Radio the other morning, and I'd been out the night before. It was Damien Fleming was about to leave the country. He was just doing the first three tests with us on the commentary. And so I woke up a little bit late, and I woke up because BBC had called my phone 25 times because I'd agreed to do an early morning radio hit, right? So we usually don't do them. The difference at the moment is most summers I get asked to do these and you say, is there a fee? And they go, no, or they come up with a very, very small amount. At the moment, I'll say this about England, the appetite is so big that people are paying, you know, people within the, you know, cricket pundits and cricket media to come on all these shows. And that is very different. There's a difference between need to fill, you know, the 42 minute mark to 58 a minute mark with a couple of people. Let's get some cricket on. And the other side of that, of literally paying random people to come on. You know, I was on with Alan Lamb on one of those shows. I had to knock back Piers Morgan because why on earth would I want to go on that show, right? All these sorts of things are happening all the time, and you know, getting messages from places that I wouldn't normally get messages from. It shows
For instance, just sorry to cut you off over there, but for instance, Piers Morgan is now going to be playing cricket on Fox and Friends. So isn't that like, doesn't that epitomize what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. These things are important for cricket, and I know that a lot of us, you know, we get bored of the Ashes sometimes, not this particular one, but as a general concept. And we get frustrated by the minutiae bullshit of the Alex Carey haircut story and all these stupid things that go around the sport. You know, Zach Crawley, we will win by 150 runs, all that sort of stuff. But when you have a really good series like this, and you can go back to, you know, Australia, India a couple of years ago, you can even go back to the Pakistan-England series even though it wasn't as close fought, but because it was England going to Pakistan, all these sorts of different, and the exciting cricket that they were playing. When these things happen, it is very good for cricket as a whole. And as a, and I don't mean as an a-hole, that wasn't a Piers Morgan joke, but what I mean is that the minutiae and the nonsense and the energy and all that sort of stuff that is going on, that most people in this chat would be like, oh God, I can't believe I have to deal with another, you know, you've got some person who doesn't know anything about cricket being an expert on some TV show, having to come on and talk about all that sort of stuff. And I understand all the energy behind that and why people would think that. But the point is that when cricket enters the mainstream, it's actually a very good thing for our sport. It means that people who wouldn't normally find it will find it. And that is important from an Australia-England point of view, but it's also important if it's some, I don't know, kid in Mexico who is suddenly trying to work out why cricket is on the TV. It, all these things matter to our sport as much as possible. And we don't get many great test series because it's hard to have a close and exciting test series. I mean, you know, we're talking about how many we've ever had where there are three tests in a row that have come down to the wire in a way that these ones have, right? In, you know, we've had back-to-back tests that are really, really close, but usually there's a drubbing after that or whatever. The fact that we've had three tight, you know, action, sloggy, weird test matches is phenomenal. And it does get attention. So it's a really good thing for cricket, even if, you know, it's more than fine if you're sitting there going, now I have to listen to some random English celebrity or worse, the Australian and English prime ministers getting involved. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I wish they would fuck it, right? I honestly always feel that in this way. I wish they would just fuck off. But what I would say is that means that it has got well beyond the sports pages and well beyond cricket diehards. And these are important things for cricket. And I'm going to take this a step further, Baram. We've got the Women's Ashes on at the moment, which is a plus and a minus. It's a minus from a media perspective because you can't cover both. Right. You know, a few people I tried to cover all. I think Jeff Lemon is covering every test match in the UK this summer. The majority of us just cannot do that. We have to take time off. You know, we have to see our families. We have to do other work, all these sorts of different things. And then you've got all the T20s and the one days, which actually clash with the test matches. So from that point of view, they haven't done very well. But this is what I'll tell you. I've been traveling around the UK this summer, and the amount of times that the test match finishes and all the cricket fans go into a pub and they make the TV person put on the cricket that's on, and it's the women's, you know, and a women's T20. Now, what are we up to? It was one day, wasn't it? T20s.
One day is now.
You know, yeah, women's one day is and all that sort of stuff. And you've got this, suddenly you've got this crowd in a pub or in a restaurant or wherever it may be of, you know, a whole bunch of people watching this thing and getting into it. So I was in a place the other night where everyone had their phones on their table, because there wasn't any TV screens at this pub. Everyone had their phones at the table watching the women's ODI, you know, come down to the end. And
The ODIs are coming up. My bad.
So why don't I know this? I should have known this. Anyway, I was watching it. I can't even remember what format I was watching. All white ball cricket's the same, let's be honest. But you're watching.
And that is
You're watching it and everyone's getting into it, right? And you're just like, this has become a cricket summer. And not all Ashes become cricket summers, and not all World Cups. 2019 was huge because it had the World Cup and the Ashes. But not all summers become like this, right? And at the moment, this has become like that. And every time cricket has a moment like this, yes, the prime ministers and the politicians and the talking heads who don't know anything about cricket and all those sort of people get involved. But it is also a chance to advertise why we love this sport in the first place.
100% concur. I mean, I've been to England a couple of times, once during the 2019 World Cup, and I didn't see that sort of hype over there, right? I had to literally find a pub where they were showing the game because I couldn't find one. We went to several ones and none of them had the cricket on. I was in London.
London's tricky for cricket. You find Manchester and Leeds, and Somerset's the best one. Somerset is the most crickety place in England. Somerset's basically, like, it's called Siderabad, of course, because the pitch thing. But it could be called Siderabad because the people there just absolutely love cricket. I remember in the 2019 World Cup going around the streets and, like, all the shopkeepers had cricket stuff up, right? Mm. And it's like, so Somerset is a little bit different. But, yeah, you do get that at times. I think by the end of the 2019 summer, after the World Cup, because England had won the World Cup, you know, and then you had the Ashes, it did get a lot bigger. But you're right, it does take a lot, you know, whereas football, some footballer can fart, you know, during a game and there's like a cloud of smoke that comes out of his ass and, you know, be on the front and back pages, right? So there is an issue from that, and we know that. Do you have any thoughts on the women's game? Because I would tell you this is the weirdest name drop ever, but it's completely by accident. Somehow I ended up having dinner next to Glenn McGrath right?
Okay.
While the women's T20 was on, right? So very random. I'm not sure the Glenn McGrath knows who I am, but somehow we ended up at the same table next to each other having dinner. And we had the game there. And of course, England were in front for the last three or four overs or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're pushing ahead. I only mentioned this story because the whole time McGrath was like, are they going to lose? They're going to bottle it. Trey's going to win this. Just because it was the most Glenn McGrath moment you could ever have.
Very, very on brand with pitch, yeah, I must say.
Exactly. So I'm hoping you saw more or have gone back to have a look at it. It was the first time, if I'm not mistaken, that Australia have lost a series of any kind in like a very, very long time. Even if it's kind of a series within a series, right? Because the Ashes is the test matches, the T20s and the one days. Yeah. And so it's like one section of that. But even so, the fact that we're mentioning it shows you how little the Australians actually lose. And they still gave it a big, big blow at the end. Pidge was quite excited towards the end. He thought Australia might steal it. But it is quite a big moment for women's cricket for Australia to have lost a series, even if it's a micro series within a larger series.
Particularly a T20 series, because they've just been so dominant in that format, recently won the T20 World Cup as well. And I will say this, that, you know, given that England have somehow managed to win this T20 series, they have sort of given them a good shot, or themselves a good shot, to actually win the Ashes, because now it's 6-4, right? Australia is leading. Of course, they won the Test. And then England won the T20 series. So Australia just 2 points ahead. And if England win the ODI series, they tie it. If they whitewash the ODI series, I reckon they'll win it. So that is just good for the women's Ashes in general. It's healthy for it. And I didn't catch much of it, I'll be honest, but England have unearthed a new superstar, you know, the all-rounder going by the name of Alice Capsey.
And yeah, her innings was incredible, yeah.
Yeah, she played a pivotal role in that final T20I and she won them the game. And I just think that even though pound for pound, I would take Australia's T20I team, but barring maybe Beth Mooney, Elise Perry, Ashley Gardner, oh mate, she didn't have a good series. Talia McGrath, they were good in patches. Alyssa Healy never showed up. And I think that is one of the main reasons why they couldn't go on and win it. And then for England, Danny Wyatt won them a game. Alice Capsey won them a game. Sophie Eccleston was really good throughout. She also got runs with the bat in one game. And she's been bowling the last over. And that I find very, very fascinating. So I think it's good fun. I know Twitter user WG Rumblepants, he's probably the best person to talk about the women's Ashes because he's been all over it. But I think
the best person is always Hypercourse. You can't go past Hypercourse. If you follow women's cricket and you're not following Hypercourse, he's incredible. He won't come on any of these podcasts, of course. There's some great people who are out there who cover it, in fact. But WG Rumblepants is certainly another one. Let's take a break. But I just want to say there's a bunch of people in the comments. So if you're desperate for us to answer a question, you can always super chat us. But if not, thank you to everyone who's in the comment. Thanks to Ahmed. Juggling Geek says, John Boy did a video about the best of stumpers cricket has reached because of these Ashes. Be fair, John Boy was onto cricket well before these Ashes. He didn't need this. If you go back, you can see some of other John Boy's videos. In fact, I should probably get John Boy on a podcast at one stage, but that would require me not having 83 test matches. Thanks to Samit, Ahmad, All Things Cinema, Rahul, Dex, although Dex, maybe stop saying the same thing over and over again. Bob and Keshev and everyone else. So many great people. Oren, everyone else. We can't get to all the chat. But remember, if you have questions, the best time to ask them is on the Wagon Wheel podcast, which I'll be doing in a couple of days' time, I'm sure. But if you do have a super chat and you're desperate to get it out, feel free. But thank you to everyone for listening. We've covered the Ashes, but we now have two retirements, World Cup qualifiers, and the strange goings-on of the World Cup qualifiers. Is that what I meant? No, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, which someone mentioned about 83 times in the podcast as well. We also have, and I'm just going to say this because I think you might play this game as well. We also have a new sponsor, which is Wicket Cricket Manager. Have you played it yet?
Yes, I really like it. It's quite addictive, really, because I don't know about you guys, but I personally love simulation games and I have been waiting for a cricket simulation game. And this is so like widespread that you can select teams from, you know, across the cricketing globe. Like I'm managing the Islamabad Eagles right now and I have a game against the Rawalpindi Rats. So big Twin City Derby over there. But yeah, I think it's very, very interesting, very intuitive sort of interface as well. You easy could do, to understand.
You can do little things too. Like you can change the size of your stadium to get more tickets. I mean, if you played some of the football and the basketball ones, I'm assuming it's similar to those. But I've only ever played Cricket Captain, which was a great game, but hasn't really been updated in a very long time. And this has so many cool things. So there's something I found today where you can upgrade yourself, and then you can then rig your pitches for whatever kind of team that you have. Yeah, Bayram hasn't even got to that level yet. although I did that and I still lost my last game, so I'm a little bit frustrated at the moment. But the point is, it's a great game. Anyway, I'm going to play an ad for it now if you haven't seen it. But they've signed up for quite a few months. They're supporting us. So even if you're just like, oh, I don't know if I like this, download this game and support, help support us, but also support them because they're trying to make a really cool cricket product. And, you know, not all, I don't want to diss Manscaped, because obviously, you know, sometimes you need to trim parts of your body, but it's a lot more fun to have cricket sponsors of stuff that me and Bayram can play. And eventually, I'm sure if we can work out how to do it, we'll be in a league against each other where the, what's your team called? The Islamabad?
Eagles.
Eagles will go up against the Melbourne Jokers. And we'll see how we go. But we'll take a quick break here and then we'll get back with the rest of the cricket.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto renews.
Thank you very much. Back to the show. Okay, let's get to Tamim Iqbal. So this happens all during the test match. And I'm going to tell the story as best I know it, right? Mm-hmm. And then feel free to give me any details, because you can imagine I was like, oh, Tamim Iqbal's retired. Oh, that's a story. Well, I'll have to think about that in a couple of days. And then Tamim Iqbal's unretired. Wait, what?
Yeah,
I hadn't even processed the first part of this. So Tamim Iqbal retires. At one stage, I want to say president of Bangladesh, or is it prime minister?
Prime minister.
Prime minister of Bangladesh gets involved and says to Tamim Iqbal, we're actually building a really good cricket team at the moment, and we're starting to win, and people are liking it again after a while, and Bangladesh needs this. They need you to come back. So within the space of 31 hours, Tamim Iqbal retires and then unretires. But he also, if I'm not mistaken, negotiates a holiday for himself as well. And it is one of the more bizarre moments in sort of modern cricket, I would have to say.
Yeah, he's definitely pulled off a Shahid Afridi over here. I mean, I had all of my farewell posts ready. I was like going berserk on it. I was like, oh my God, Tamim Iqbal is retired. One of the biggest, you know, cricketers to have ever played for Bangladesh. And here we are, he's back and now he has a vacation. So you got that part right. I can add a bit to the story. So it all started with Tamim having a faulty back. His back wasn't 100%. He had been honest about it. And when questioned about it, he had told, I reckon, Nazmul Hasan, the BCB president, that he's going to play the first game and assess whether or not his back is doing well. So the BCB president did not appreciate that. He called it unprofessional. And that interview was published in a newspaper. So that is what stirred everything. And then next thing you know it, Tamim Iqbal calls for a press conference. He has a very teary, press conference, says goodbye to the game in a very emotional manner, all formats. So it's very, very, you know, what's the right word over here? Dramatic.
Final. Yeah.
Yeah, that as well. And next thing you know, you've got Mashrafi Murtaza, who has facilitated a meetup between Tamim Iqbal and Sheikh Hasina, who is Bangladesh's president. Not the first time she's gotten involved with something Tamim related. There was a story back in 2012 where Tamim was dropped for the team from the Asia Cup, and then she intervened and Tamim was back in the squad. So there is precedent for this. And so then Tamim goes on to post that you can't say no to the prime minister. And now we're back.
Is it president
with
or prime minister? Because you said president a moment ago, but then you corrected me.
Oh, did I? Sorry. I'm so quite sure it's Prime Minister.
Prime Minister. Okay, gotcha. No, just because there's already a BCB president in this. So it's already, there's already a lot of people with fancy titles. Okay.
Even that guy wasn't happy, right? The BCB president wasn't happy at all when he heard this news, and he demanded Tamim to take his retirement back. But all things said and done, Tamim has a vacation now. He's probably going to be leading Bangladesh in the ODI World Cup. But what this has done, this entire episode, it's really papered over the cracks within Bangladesh cricket, because they've been humbled by Afghanistan in the ODI series. They couldn't make 200 in two games. And this is a series at home. So I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it was a very interesting, you know, so I have this weird relationship with Tamim Iqbal because I saw him make the 100 at Lord's. And it was one of the last things I ever did as a cricket fan, right? So I was already writing a blog. So things that, and I did a little bit as a journalist, but I wasn't in the press box or anything else. And so for me, I was like, oh, well, that's the end of my life as a cricket fan, right? That Tamim is kind of the last person there. And I also understand that back injuries are for batters do eventually, I wouldn't say they end a lot of careers, but generally what happens is once you injure your back, you're never the player that you were before. You know, Michael Clark and Mike Atherton and these sorts of guys, they really, really struggle from that point of view. And it is tricky. And then you've also got the interference, of course, of the BCB of just being like, that's unprofessional. That's kind of what he should be doing, right? He should be trying to see what he can do. I mean, that's a sin. What he's having a go at is exactly what Ben Stokes has been doing in the last few tests, which is, think I can bowl. I'm not sure. Yeah. Oh, I can bowl in the first two tests. I can't really bowl in the third test. Maybe I'll bowl in the fourth test. I'll bowl a couple of overs and check it out. Like, you don't know. I'm Moeen Ali in his finger. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable story. But for Bangladesh, I just think that even if Tamim does slip a little bit and his back isn't as good as it used to be, he's such an important player to them. There isn't an obvious
100%.
There isn't an obvious replacement for him. Not even if he was just in the squad, his experience, professionalism, everything he's been through is quite handy for them. They have to make sure that one way or another he is happy and hopefully still helping out with Bangladesh cricket. Yeah. So
he's also someone who goes around very well, you know, with the youngsters. He's someone who lifts them up. And I think the one person who could probably answer all these questions is the coach. So Bangladesh's coach, Chandika Hathurasinghe, I hope I've gotten the pronunciation right. So the BCB president said that he had a chat with him and he wasn't happy at all. So this is the relationship that will probably matter most in months to come, because those are going to be the two guys who are going to be at the helm in India. Tamim Iqbal, the captain, and the coach. So if that relationship is fine, I think everything's sorted.
Yeah. No, it's hopefully they have sorted it out. But what I would say is, if you're running a cricket board and you've had a meeting with a player that has gone, or in this case, released a press interview with a player that has lost one of your best players from all three formats, you might want to rethink how you deal with them, because that's just, it's an untenable situation going ahead. All right, Afghanistan, Bangladesh. I'm aware that this happened. I'm aware that there was a game. I think I forget who it was before. He was putting lots of different comments into the in about it. Tell me about the game.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've already mentioned that Bangladesh failed to score 200 on two consecutive occasions. So, I mean, you're not going to win a lot of ODI games if that happens. And there's not much to write home about, really, with respect to Bangladesh cricket. So I'm just going to give you some context with respect to Afghanistan. Yeah. I've probably mentioned this before, that Afghanistan are probably set with respect to this spin attack, which is world class and probably good for the next decade. And we know that they bring in a lot of quality. And if they are going to win some games in India later this year, it's going to be on the back of that spin attack. But another thing that they've gotten right for themselves, or something that's been going really well, is that now they have a left-arm pacer who looks like quality. Like Fazal Haq Farooqi has gotten 6 wickets in 2 games, and Azhar Mahmood is someone who has coached him at Islamabad United and is all praise. And this is some guy who could actually, you know, turn the tide with respect to Afghanistan's fortunes in the ODI World Cup and limited overs cricket in general. So I think that is a main key takeaway. And also the fact that both their openers, Rehmanullah Gurbaz, who of course we've seen in a multitude of different franchise leagues across the T20 circuit, and then Ibrahim Zadran, who is off to quite the start in his ODI career. I remember we covered him a few podcasts back that he was the quickest to 500 runs or something. Both of those guys got tons in the second ODI and got more runs in the first one as well. So I think Afghanistan have two really solid players opening for them who complement each other well. Zadran digs in deep, plays his shots, takes his time. And Gurbaz is just that flashy guy who, if he gets off, he could really, really hurt you. Rehmat Shah is a bit slow at first drop, but he's gotten runs. So I think they're a bit top heavy. After that, they're relying on their all-rounders a little lower down the order because they've had a few retirements as well. Afghanistan look good. They've looked better than they've ever looked going into a World Cup. And now that their players are a bit experienced as well, Rashid Khan has been around for a while. Mohammad Nabi, even though, you know, he might not be at his best anymore, he is very, very experienced. I think they've got a team that could win them a few games because they haven't had that yet, right? They haven't won a game at the Cricket World Cup just as yet. So I would say watch out for Afghanistan because these are going to be Indian surfaces. And if they play at Chennai, I mean, I'd say they'd be level peggings with some of the bigger teams out there.
I think they've won a game at the World Cup, haven't they? Because they might not have beaten a test nation at the World Cup. Mm. Didn't they beat Scotland in a ridiculous game somewhere in Australia? I can't even remember where the game was played. I know it wasn't at, it was one of the few Scotland games I didn't go to where I think, was it 10 and 11 might have chased down a bunch of runs at the end, or certainly it was a tail ender that was a number 11 or number 10 that was involved. But yeah, no, they haven't won enough games. Their biggest problem is that their ability to score 260 consistently, which is what you really need to be able to do to keep yourself in so many ODI games, is not there.
Right.
Individual bowling talent, I don't think is ever massively a problem, although I do think that their bowlers are more suited to T20 than they are to Test cricket. ODI. But yeah, look, it's interesting. Someone, who was it there? Ahmed said, should Afghans be called the dark horses for the World Cup? I mean, they're not going to win the World Cup.
Not quite.
I think that if them or the best case scenario for them or Bangladesh should be to be in the running for a semi-final spot. Mm-hmm. If they can get to being in the running for a semi-final spot, that's huge for them.
Yeah.
If somehow either of those teams manages to get in, I think that's also fantastic. But yeah, no one's sitting here thinking that. Just before we get to the World Cup qualifiers and the World Cup, now that we know what it is, being that we're talking about retirements, we just go into the Ambadu Raidu retirement. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm going to give you what I know, which is very little. In fact, I think you texted me about it yesterday and I was like, what's he talking about? And I had to go look it up literally in the car on the way back from Leeds. But I wasn't driving, by the way. Jeff Lemon was driving. If you need it, to know why I wasn't driving. But you know, when I got that text, I had a look. So Raidu retired from IPL cricket. I think he's a fascinating player. We'll eventually do a big video essay on him. I just haven't got around to it. It might come out before the next IPL. But I think he's a fascinating player and he's been involved in so many random things in Indian cricket. It's such a bizarre story. He retires. He then signs with the Texas Super Kings in America for the Major League Cricket. And then that has now been revoked because the BCCI have a new rule, which says I think it might have been unspoken before, that you have to be retired for 12 months before you can play in leagues outside of India. Have I got all that right?
Yeah, I think you have, because Jay Shah basically came out and said that the BCCI is proposing a year-long cooling-off period for retired players, that they won't be able to or be allowed to play any franchise T20 cricket till after a year. From when they retire. And I think this is quite absurd, really, because Ambati Raidu is not going to be playing for India anymore. So basically, you're tying him down just to the IPL, and he's gone out on a high. He's retired. He's won the goddamn IPL. And I feel for him, because I get it why India, you know, make sure that their players don't play other leagues and focus on the IPL and Indian cricket. But we're going towards a future where global franchise T20 cricket is going to be huge. And you can see, like, the MCL, Major League Cricket, MLC, it's proof of that, right? Unmukh Chand is another Indian player who's gone down that route. And it's interesting how the BCCI really don't want any of their player pool to be engaging in cricket activities elsewhere. And a year-long cooling-off period means you're taking a year away from an athlete. They already have a limited amount of years to earn their paycheck. So I feel for him, and I think I mean, the Super Kings franchise is going to be pissed, aren't they? Because he was their player at Chennai, and the Texas Super Kings are going to be, they were going to benefit from his experience a lot. And he's still a very, very good bat.
Oh, so I think Look, it's weird. If you're going to make that rule, I think you have to then pay them for that year. You have to give it has to be
compensation.
It has to be gardening leave, right? Yeah. You worked in the corporate world, you know what I'm talking about, where you leave a company and the company says, we don't, you know, you're an accountant for us. We don't want you to go and be an accountant for the opposition. We're going to pay you for 9 months not to work, right?
Yeah.
So that you don't work for anyone else. And then by the time you get there, that's fine. We'll have worked out everything that we need to know.
No, and what happens if he does go on and play for the Texas Super Kings, right? Are you going to fine him? Like, I don't get it.
There's a reason why this exists. And it's because, and I think Oren put a message in about the restriction of trade. It is obviously restriction of trade. It's nonsense. The reason he won't do it is because if he goes and plays now, there might be a no objection certificate situation where he might not be able to get that certificate, which would put the Major League Cricket in an awkward situation. But the other reason would be he would never get any commentary gigs. He would never get any coaching gigs. He would never get anything else. So what the BCCI are doing is fine if they pay for it. If they say, okay, well, over the 15 years of cricket where you played for India or available for India, you made this amount of money. We're going to even that out and say it's this amount. And so that you got this much per year, we'll give you 1 year of that. So he doesn't lose any income. I mean, he will. He might lose income if.
Or you could put an age parameter to it, right? If you're under 30, then with a predetermined retirement, you can have that clause. But if Rayudu, who's probably like on the wrong side of 30 by now,
Has he retired before?
Rayudu?
Yeah.
Yes, I think he has.
So that's the other thing, and this is where I think what the IPL is also trying to say to players is you can't retire from the IPL, go and play Major League Cricket. And then suddenly next year go, do you know what? I'm feeling great. I can play in the IPL. Right? So I do think there's a lot of moving parts here. But I've got, as I said, I've absolutely no problem. You can pro-rata out how much he's going to get paid. Here's your gardening. I suppose we could call it gardening leave in cricket as well, because cricket is gardening on the pitch. Here's your gardening leave. Your gardening leave for the next year. We know that you could go and play in the T20 tournament or, you know, maybe the South African tournament or play some blast cricket or whatever that may be, or go off to one of the more, you know, the other tournaments, whatever that may be. And we don't want you to do that. So we are now going to pay you for that the next year at a reduced rate. You're not going to get your full IPL salary from last year or anything like that. But we've looked at what you got paid over the course of your career, and we're going to give you this amount of money. I think that would be a very, very fair thing to be able to do, or a way of looking at it. And if you're not going to do that, then what they're doing is just not acceptable, right? I mean, there's no other way around it. It's not an acceptable thing to do. I understand why they're doing it. They don't want Indian players going off and making money for other leagues. They don't want players getting around the system by retiring and unretiring and retiring and unretiring. All those sorts of things. I understand all that. But my point would be that it doesn't matter. As you said, if you're a 36-year-old and you can no longer play in, be a frontline player in the IPL, but you might still have 4 or 5 years of playing in English cricket available to you if you want to go and play first-class cricket. You might have a bunch of bouncing around smaller leagues that you can do. You know, to be able to take that away from someone just seems really, really unfair. But to be fair, this is exactly what I expect to happen to Rayudu, because every single thing that can happen to a human being in a cricket career seems to have happened to him at one stage, which is why he's such a fascinating person. Anyway, we'll take another break. And then after the break, we'll talk a little bit about the World Cup qualifiers. You're listening to the Uncovered Podcast. I am Jared Kimber, and with me is Bayram Karsi. All right. Let us finish with the World Cup qualifiers. Again, I didn't see as much. I saw the Scotland game, a Scotland-Netherlands game, which was fantastic. You know, finished the way that Netherlands brought that off. Again, you know, someone who's worked for Scotland and knows a lot of those players and has also written about the history of Scottish cricket that is a little bit haunted, and they don't make a lot of these tournaments. It was a very, very sad moment, but couldn't be any happier for the Dutch cricket, especially because it was the Dutch second 11 is unfair, but not all the major Dutch players. And I think that with Scottish cricket and Irish cricket at times, that they've had some success with their lower level players. The Dutch really have probably been at their absolute best when players like, you know, Dirk Nannis and Tom Cooper and the guys, you know, as the South Africans who play county cricket, all those sort of guys have been available to them. For them to be able to achieve something this big over Zimbabwe, who played great cricket, West Indies, who's, you know, a major test nation, well, used to be a major test nation, Scotland, who was playing really good cricket. I just think it's absolutely huge for Dutch cricket. And, you know, you watched a little bit of them last summer when they're playing Pakistan, I'm sure. I watched a lot of them last summer. I think I commentated on a huge amount of their games. There's no way the team I saw that last summer should have been qualifying for the World Cup. So huge shout out to them for how much they have improved in the space of 12 months. And the other thing that I would say here is that that was the best summer of cricket that Dutch cricket has ever had, right? As in, they played so many different teams, high quality teams. Everyone went over there into it. And sure, there were low moments, like the world record against England, But you have to say that in them playing all those teams, right, they have actually improved as a nation. And again, we're in the same situation here of going, if you let the associates play, they will get better.
100%. I mean, it's just like proof that exposure really does wonders. And Netherlands played the West Indies, played England, played Pakistan. They might have lost those games, but ultimately they've gone on to qualify for the World Cup. And I think it's very important to mention that all of that bowling attack, or pretty much that bowling attack in its entirety that defeated South Africa in the T20 World Cup, wasn't available to them in this World Cup qualifier tournament. You have the likes of Roelof van der Merwe, who's a big player in that team, Fred Klaassen, Van Meekeren, and I'm probably forgetting a few names. King Ma is another one, Glover. I think. Brandon Glover. So all of those guys weren't at their disposal, and you really have to tip your hat off to two players in particular. Pastor Leder, I mean, his father has played three World Cups, so he's carried on that legacy. Shout out to Shafkat Shabir, who brought that to my attention before Crick Info, which is why I'm giving you a shout out, Shafkat. And I mean, he took a fifer and scored 120 odd at ridiculous pace, right?
In that game, like, if you if that happens in a random game, you're like, well, and we all know how talented he is. I've been writing a lot about him and following him for quite some time now. We know how to, but to do it in that game is just absolutely mind blowing, isn't it?
High pressure, and it's just his arc, which is so fascinating. You remember he got knocked on the face by Harris Rauf, right? And then that impacted Netherlands' squad composition and where he was playing. And then they went on to beat South Africa. Now they've gone on to qualify for the World Cup. And this is huge, because here's a team which wasn't with their best 11, and they were up against quality, right? That win against the West Indies, they chased down, or didn't chase down, but they leveled their score of 370 odd. And then Logan van Beek smashed 30 in that super over. And that was it. Game, set, match. They needed to defeat Scotland.
And then
Scotland.
Took two wickets in the super over as well.
Yes. And they needed to defeat Scotland by a very, very hefty margin. They had to chase down 270 in 44 overs or something. Yeah. So to be able to achieve that against a team which was definitely pound for pound, you'd have to say, better than them. And Scotland, you know, a lot of us were thinking they would go on to qualify after they defeated Zimbabwe. I think we cannot possibly, you know, describe in words how big of an achievement this is for Dutch cricket. And I hope that they get some games in the build-up to the World Cup. I saw KNVB cricket post something on Twitter in which they were like, we'd love to play some games in the subcontinent. So I hope that Pakistan invites them. They're not playing a lot of cricket before the Asia Cup. That would be great to see. And also they're looking for a sponsor, apparently. So if someone's watching this video, please go ahead and sponsor these boys. They deserve it. And you'll get good coverage in the World Cup. So I think it's amazing. What a story. Love to see it. And some European flavor to our game is something that's very welcome. And also, Jared, we both were convinced that Zimbabwe were going to qualify. Mm. And they didn't. They lost two games in a row, and their net run rate was so low that they didn't even have a shot prior to that Scotland-Netherlands game.
Yeah. It's also just worth saying in general that there were, 13, maybe 14 teams in this tournament where you were just like, these are World Cup quality teams. And I think any World Cup in the world, and it's the same with the Olympics. It's funny that when the Olympics comes along, you know, Eric the Eel or whatever the other guy is, the skier, I've forgotten his name. But those sorts of people, they actually give as much to the World Cup to the Olympics as the winners sometimes, right? But even if you pair it back, we now have 14 teams that are clearly of World Cup quality. Doesn't mean they won't get belted. Netherlands got absolutely belted by Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka's in a really weird situation. We've seen them in so many qualifiers of recent times where no one in the qualification can play their spinners. But when they get to the next level, they can't rely on the spinners at the same level.
Yeah.
And they're just not as good a team. But you know, you look at, you know, Ireland as Ireland was not did not have a good tournament at all, but they still are definitely of World Cup quality, right?
Yeah.
And it just shows you how silly it is to be restricting it. So I think it's absolutely great that the Netherlands have got in, especially because it is such a tight package. You know, this isn't like Netherlands have played at World Cups where they've just been there because the World Cup's been big enough and they've been available. Mm-hmm. This isn't like that. Right. They had to absolutely, you know, they had to beat three test nations, right? Three test nations Netherlands had to get past to get to this World Cup. Absolutely extraordinary from that point of view. But you look at the West Indies and Ireland and Oman played some really good cricket at times. Mm-hmm. UAE is probably one of the few teams that you look at and you go, maybe in a couple of years, they're still rebuilding after everything that happened with them. There's so much talent out there. It is an absolute shame that we've still got this stupid style of World Cup just because to placate some teams and because
you could have like a 14 team World Cup and have two groups of seven, and then the top two could qualify from those two groups of seven, and that allows four.
No,
more
you
teams
can't.
In the
you can only have 10 teams. I think that's the law. No, look, there's a million different ways. I would love to have 16 or 18 or 20 teams, and then maybe in 10 years' time look to grow that even more. The quality of cricket, I remember, you know, being involved with Scotland with the qualifiers for the T20, what was that, 2018 or 2019, whenever I was there. There's still good quality cricketers with Kenya, right? There's so many players. You know, Singapore had, you know, this incredible run. It wasn't just Tim David on his own. Tim David wasn't averaging 150 for Singapore and taking eight wickets every game, right? They were winning games of cricket. They beat Nepal, right? Can get better as well. Like, there's so many different things that can.
Hong Kong is another one, right? Hong Kong's done really well.
Qualified a few years ago as well. You're right. USA is obviously on the rise. So I do think that. Well, I said they're on the rise. They weren't particularly on the rise in this tournament, but USA could be on the rise. Maybe the best way of putting it. So I do think there's a lot to like about all those sorts of things, and I certainly think going ahead that this is a very, very important change. But that doesn't take anything away from the Netherlands did or Sri Lanka in their victory either. It's just pointing out that what the game needs to be. Anyway, mate,
one last thing.
No,
one
I was ending thing. The podcast. You heard me ending the podcast.
I'm just saying Sri Lanka will be a handful of this World Cup because it's in India, and Tikshana and Hasaranga are a really good pairing. And also, if anyone is watching from the PCB, get Netherlands to play in Pakistan. You owe them a debt from the T20 World Cup, okay? They deserve it. That's all.
That's a fair point. I love that. Uncovered Podcast. He's Bayram Kazi. You can find him on Def Mango over on Twitter and whatever he's called on Threads. Maybe the same thing. You called the same thing?
Nah. Are you on Threads? I don't use that app. So it's B Kazi. Okay. Very, very basic. Very vanilla.
Find him wherever you need to find him, everywhere else. We've got a bunch of stuff coming out. We just had a video about the last day of the Ashes. And if I finish it, hopefully by Wednesday, there'll be a huge piece on Steve Smith up on the YouTube. We've got plenty of other podcasts and everything else. My one final plea is please follow the Jared Kimber podcast channel. If you love, especially if you're one of those people who's in the chat right now and is asking questions and want things to be answered, we will probably buy the World Cup. Be exclusively doing these videos on the Jared Kimber podcast channel, which means that by that point, your only way of watching them live will be there, unless you want to go and find them on the podcast channel, in podcast apps, so in normal places. But if you want to have them live, the Jared Kimber podcast channel is the only way to go. But for now, thank you very much, and we'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Saina Payu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content. Podcast Network.